When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, ladies, gentlemen, fanatics of all ages. Welcome to another episode of Phillies Therapy, the podcast about your major league best Philadelphia Phillies. What?
Crazy.
What? The Phillies are 24-11. They have won 16 of 19 games for the first time since late 2010. They are on an absolute heater. I don't want to hear your complaints about strength of schedule. You got to win the games. They're winning the games. And right now they're sitting pretty, 24-11. It's wild. They lead the NL East by 2.5 games. They have a multi-game lead in the division on consecutive days for the first time in about 5 years. This is sort of uncharted territory right now as we kick things off with relatively few things to complain about, although I guess there are a couple of concerns. We wouldn't be a Philly sports team podcast without that. So welcome in, everybody. I am Paul Boyer, joined as always by The Athletic's Matt Gill. Matt, hello. How's your weekend been?
Good, Paul. I'm excited for this episode. We have our first ever guest on the show, and it's a pretty good one. I think people are going to enjoy hearing from him.
Yeah, it's true. You know, I was able to pull in a couple of pinch hitters when we first started this a couple of years ago now.
True, when you
had to take leave. It is the first time both of us have tag teamed on an interview, and hopefully we didn't sound too overwhelming. We're not fearsome, are we? We're friendly. People can talk to us. That's the whole point of this, right? Well, I guess if not, we always have each other. So the Phillies keep winning games, but I don't know. You might have heard the rather unfortunate injury news that happened over the weekend where shortstop Trey Turner will miss approximately 6 weeks with a hamstring strain. Part of me, the angry part of me, the irrational part of me, seeing that this is a San Francisco Giants series, will associate this with the Giants like I do every other annoying thing that happens during the course of a regular season, and say they caused this, and it is unfortunate, and I will take everything out on them. Turner, of course, injured himself trying to score from second base on a wild pitch. He did. He scored successfully, gave his hamstring up in the process. And now things are going to be a little interesting up the middle. Matt, we actually talked about this hypothetically before the season started, hoping it wouldn't really come true, but in the event that someone up the middle went down or Turner had to miss an extended period of time, we thought about this. We mapped it out a little bit, and it may take that form, you know, with Bryson Stott moving over. But for now, it looks like Edmundo Sosa is going to fill in at shortstop. It seems like the team is prepared to take on Trey's absence, but I guess there's really only so much you can do to actually be ready for a prolonged absence from one of your star players like this.
Yeah, and I would say I'm not going to – you don't – blame the Giants for it, but you know, Tom Murphy. Yeah, I mean, it was a pass ball that he should have gotten to. And honestly, after the game, Trey was like, you know, I'm probably not trying unless, you know, if the catcher reacts better. That's the thing. It wasn't just the pass ball. It was the way that Tom Murphy really nonchalantly went after it that Turner was like, oh crap. Like I can do this. I can go for it. So yes, I think that the Giants are responsible for Trey Turner's hamstring. And yes, I'm just being a little flippant, but it's a tough injury. You know, if it's 6 weeks, 7 weeks, 8 weeks, whatever it is, you know, you're talking about the most dynamic player on the roster. You're not just talking about your shortstop. You're talking about, you know, a guy who is firmly your number two hitter. And that's because you need a right-handed hitter to slot between Kyle Schwarber and Bryce Harper. And outside of Trey Turner, there are not a lot of tremendous options for that. you know, obviously they've settled on JT Realmuto to start in that two hole spot. Mm-hmm. There really was, by the process of elimination, there were two choices essentially. It was JT or Alec Bohm. And right now, and understandably so, Rob Thompson's like, look, I don't want to disrupt, you know, what Alec Bohm has been doing in the cleanup spot. It's a run production spot. You know, this guy's our best run producer, you know, not gonna disrupt with this. And I think that's the right call. So it was Realmuto who ends up at this two hole. And then, you know, Saturday and Sunday, his first two games there, he had two tremendous games. He actually Saturday saw, I think, the second most pitches he's seen in a game all year. He walked twice. Sunday, he has three singles. You know, a guy's not going to change his approach when he moves into a different spot in the batting order, but I'm sure that's in his head. I mean, because number two, it's an on base spot. I mean, you're trying to get on base in front of Bryce Harper and Alec Bohm. And, you know, JT is not always had the best on base skills, especially in recent years. Last year was his worst on base percentage, I think, since his rookie year. So, you know, maybe this is a way to jumpstart him. I think, you know, we look at JT as a guy who's not necessarily, you know, he's probably, you know, past his prime at this point. Probably not a guy who's going to mix both power and patience over the course of a full season. So if you think you can get one of those things, maybe the patience aspect, the on base skill, for the time being, I think that could help them. In the field, Paul, like, I, you know, they're going to give Sosa the first crack. I would not be surprised if when they play this game in a few hours, and we're taping Monday morning, that Bryson Stott plays shortstop Monday afternoon. He did not get any work there this over the weekend because it rained every day before the game. They couldn't get him on the field. I do think that eventually it's going to be Stott at shortstop and Whit Merrifield at second base, and not every day, but most days. I understand why they want to give Sosa a crack here. I think we saw last year he can be a productive player, but it, you know, when given a lot of at bats in a short span, I think he can get exposed. I mean, I think we even saw Sunday night. I mean, there's some really rough at bats that he took Sunday night, and he likes to swing. We know that. We've joked about it on here before, but he's probably not an everyday guy. And when we're talking about 6 weeks, that's okay. I mean, like, you have different options here to try to fill this, you know, huge hole. You're not going to replace Trey Turner, but you try to fill it. And so this is the first shot. I think that Stott's going to get a lot of the shortstop time.
I think if there's one silver lining I try and take from this, and that's what I'm doing, because losing a player like Trey Turner for a month and a half is not an enjoyable experience. But I look at the schedule, right? I mean, I made a crack about the strength of schedule, but I look at the schedule and, you know, he might miss the London series, which I guess, you know, the league is probably a little bit bummed about that, whatever. But the Phillies don't play the Braves again. We've mentioned this before, until early July. And that right now is the big opponent. They've got some other, you know, fellow postseason wildcard contenders along the way for sure.
Sure.
And there isn't like a ton of strength in the, you know, intermittent time period here over
the next just getting at is that most of the league is terrible.
Most of the league is not
most of the league
good.
Is terrible.
I mean, this is ooh. And he could be, if everything goes well, Turner could be back before that Braves series, that next Braves series in Atlanta.
Yeah.
The weekend of July 5th through 7th, which is huge. Yeah. I mean, if
I think something's gone really wrong if he's not back by then.
Yeah. And if I'm setting a benchmark, that I want him back for that series.
Right.
Anything before, excellent, great. You know, we see who's on the roster now and what the likely plan is to try and make it work. And okay. They'll get through it. I mean, the last two games, they've been fine, but there will be
sure.
times
I mean,
they
need some guys to step up. I mean, Nick Castellanos needs to start to hit here. I mean, there's some of their right-handed hitters got hit. JT and Nick, the onus now falls on them.
Yes, it does. In the meantime, and this is relevant to the conversation we're going to have a little bit later in this episode, the pitching staff is there to pick them up. They've done nothing but continue to be really, really good. You know, they're second in the NL in ERA by 0.001. They're pitching an enormous amount of innings from their starting rotation. They lead the majors in batters faced, you know, third time plus through the order from their starters, which is a huge thing in today's game. They have so many starting pitchers. They've moved Spencer Turnbull and his sub 2 ERA to the bullpen to accommodate the return of Taijuan Walker, who started on Sunday night. And for the second straight start, looked fine until his final inning.
Yeah.
Matt, I don't know if I can say enough about the way the pitching has gone, but they're going to need to keep doing this or something close to it, while their offense is a bit hindered. Like, does a little more pressure now fall on the pitching staff to try and replicate what they did in that first month?
Yeah, maybe. I think in the immediate, more pressure falls on some of the complementary hitters. You know, more pressure falls on Bryson Stott to have better at bats. And he has, honestly. Like, he's had much better at bats the last 7 to 10 days. He's starting to get on base again. You know, the pressure should fall to JT Realmuto and Nick Castellanos and Kyle Schwarber. You know, Kyle Schwarber is a guy who, let's remember, like, Rob Thompson said this in the wake of the Trey Turner. He said, we've been through this before. And what was the biggest example of them losing a star player in the middle of the season, you know, at a shaky time? And that was when Bryce Harper took a pitch from Blake Snell off the thumb and broke it. Mm-hmm. And that was the summer of 2022 when, you know, we weren't really sure what to make of the Phillies yet. Rob Thompson's the interim manager. They just lost their best player. The season was sort of on the brink. Yeah. And that is when Kyle Schwarber really stepped up as both a leader in the lineup, but also in the clubhouse. And they sort of established identity. And he went on this heater with Bryce Harper out, and they sort of formed this identity, scrapped, you know, without their best player, their star player. And, you know, Harper gets back and they ride to the playoffs and then they go to the World Series, obviously. But to me, I'm looking at this right now and Kyle Schwarber has underperformed big time. And we're not to June yet. We're not at June Schwarber yet, which would be a big boost for them if they got June Schwarber again. But if,
yes, it would.
You know, if they got him before June 1st, that would be, you know, that would help, because I look at him and I see him as a guy who should and can step up here, not just in the clubhouse in terms of, you know, making sure everyone's not, you know, overreacting or getting down to losing, you know, one of your best players, which I don't think they will. And it helps that they've banked 24 wins in 35 games. But he's a guy who could really make this thing feel a lot better if he starts getting on base and hitting for power at the top of the lineup. So, the pitchers, yeah, I mean, there's of course there's pressure to keep going, and I think what's great about how they've done it so far is that they haven't had to lean too much on some of these relievers, and they know that there will be a stretch where they have to do that. But man, Paul, like, I'm looking at some of the performances by these guys, and you know, Jeff Hoffman and Matt Strom, you know, they've combined for 44 strikeouts and 6 walks in 29 innings. Like, that's that's pretty good. You know, Jose Alvarado hasn't been his best. His velocity hasn't been there, but it's been okay. Like, they haven't, you know, he's still gotten results. They've barely had to use Orion Kerkering, and he's going to get, you know, they're going to lean on him a little bit here moving forward. So I think the pitching is in good shape. Like you mentioned, Turnbull is going to be in the bullpen now, and we'll see, you know, what happens. I think they're, you know, reserving the right to make a change whenever they want to make a change. And that's, you know, that's the way it should be. But banking wins early is just massive, because you knew there was going to be an injury. You're just hoping it's not a major injury that, you know, costs a guy his year, but you know, there's going to be an injury. And here's Trey Turner with a hamstring injury. He's going to miss 6 weeks. And guess what? It would feel like the walls were closing in if they were at 500 right now, right?
It would feel tough. It would feel tough. But, you know, that's one thing that I think has emerged early on with this team is that, you know, yes, some of these series have been against lesser teams. Not everything has been a walkover. They're not, you know, stomping everybody they play.
No, they're striking out like 17, 18 times in some of these games and winning them. They're winning games that they would not normally win.
That is the exact point I was going for, Matt, is that, yes, like twice in the last week alone, they struck out 17 and 18 times and won both of those games. When the offense strikes out more than 10 times in a game, so far they are 5-2. This is like, that is, it's winning ugly, sure, but it's winning. Yeah. It's finding a way to pull this stuff out. It's that one of those unquantifiable elements where something else has to go right on days where everything isn't running as a well-oiled machine, right? If you're striking out 17 or 18 times as an offensive unit, you're not bringing your A game. You're just not. You're having an off night as a unit. And the fact is, when that has happened, largely, except for those other two games, they've been able to pull it out. Those other two games, by the way, the two losses started by Spencer Strider and Sonny Gray, who are pretty good. So, like, that happens. But they took it to Logan Webb a bit, right? There was a big blow, that Harper homer.
Some good at bats, yeah.
Great at bats. They made him throw more than 20 pitches, 3 straight innings. Like, this is one of the top pitchers in the National League.
Yeah.
And they handled him. So it's encouraging. It's encouraging all the way through. You know, the pitching is what's been carrying the day so far, but the offense is still finding ways to, you know, they'll still leave a couple guys on. You know, they weren't without that last night, but they're finding ways to get enough across to make it work.
Yeah. And winning,
that's great.
Right. And winning ugly against bad teams like that, that is, they are just exerting their might over some of these teams. I mean, they are just a better roster than a lot of the teams that they've played. And so, yes, they should be expected to win a lot of these games, but it doesn't always work that way. And, but when you can win 24 out of 35, I mean, you have done everything and more. I mean, really, like you have beaten inferior competition, but you just haven't beaten them at a decent clip. You've beaten them at a great clip. And that is what great teams do.
So that has been the week that was. Again, the Phillies are 24-11. They have a 2.5 game lead over Atlanta in the East. They currently possess, I'll say this again because I am enjoying this in the moment, the best record in baseball. They have a half game lead over Baltimore. They're about a game and a half ahead of the Dodgers back over in the NL. Things are looking good. And, you know, like you said, banking those wins, very important.
Yeah, because there will be stretches where it doesn't look good. We know that.
That's true. That's true. Yeah. Okay, we're going to take the briefest of breaks, and we'll be back on the other side of this brief little musical interlude with a special guest. So I would stay tuned if I were you, and we'll see you on the other side. Our guest today, yes, you heard that right, spent parts of two seasons with the Cincinnati Reds and New York Yankees and quickly joined the coaching ranks, where he has risen quickly. He joined the Phillies before the 2021 season after the departure of the man across the field from him during this weekend's Giants series, Brian Price. He is the man responsible for the pitching staff that currently sits second in the National League in ERA by 1,000th of a point. So they're basically first. And he joins us now on Phillies Therapy. That is Phillies pitching coach, Caleb Cotham. Caleb, thank you so much for joining us. How are you?
I'm doing great, Paul. Thanks for having me. Matt, too. Appreciate it. I'm excited to talk.
You might not lead the National League in overall ERA, but you lead the National League in starters ERA. It's like 2.65. And also, you have pitched more innings from your starting staff by 8, I think, the next closest team I'm looking at right now. I know from your standpoint, there's a lot of things you've been excited about, Caleb, but I'm wondering what has been the most satisfying thing for you, you know, during these first 35 games, but also like what makes you think that for the rotation, at least, you know, a lot of this is sustainable.
Yeah, I'm definitely proud of the pitchers themselves and taking care of the buildup, taking care of coming into spring training prepared. You know, there wasn't that many hiccups there. So I think they got off to a good start. Like Ranger flipped the script on kind of his early season stuff that he dealt with. He came in really prepared, and he's been rewarded with good performance just because he was prepared. But you know, those guys, they came in good. They built up well. And honestly, I think, you know, I could make a case that, you know, really Zach hasn't hit his stride necessarily. I don't think Knowles has hit his stride, but I'm really proud of their ability to, you know, pitch deep early in a season while not also doing anything risky. So it's been impressive. I mean, it's kept the bullpen availability as good as you could ask. And as some of those guys have pitched a lot recently, and that's just the nature of the bullpen. But you know, the starters going deep, it's not easy to do that. You got to be good, and you got to be healthy, and you got to take care of your routine. And they've been really good in that way.
I think the point about preparation is a really salient and current one right now because of just the number of injuries across the league, right? We saw in the first week or two, really throughout all of April, it's just been hard to keep a lot of these guys on the field for various different reasons. For the most part, the Phillies have been healthy. You know, Junior went down recently and you know, there's been a little bit here and there. They haven't been totally immune. For the most part, that preparation you talked about, it seems like it's really paying off. What has it been like trying to keep these guys healthy? Not really just this year, but, you know, throughout your time here, because with the max effort. Guys throw harder. It just seems like injuries are lurking, but the Phillies have done a good job of staying on the field and staying available.
Yeah, it's a really tough problem. Everyone's trying to solve it. I'm not going to sit here and say we have the answer. We do have a process, and I'm proud of how we've stuck to that process, but also iterated. You know, fourth year, just seeing the evolution of the people, but also the attention to detail that's just been elevated over the years. And Paul Buchheit, athletic trainer, Morgan Gregory, and Topper, man at the helm, making it really important to be really connected across departments and us understanding every day how a guy's presenting on the training table, how he's presenting in the weight room, what he's saying. Because, guys, they'll say different things to different people, not nefariously, but I'm not even sure if that's a word, but there's different things are said to different people. And, we want to be connected. And the more we know and the more honest and upfront conversation we can have, the better we can create a plan of care. But I think, we don't have a group of starters that are trying to redline every pitch. I think, you look at our guys and there's intent to throw the ball hard. And they throw hard, but one of the benefits of throwing hard that, in my opinion, you need to be able to throw hard so that you don't have to, so that your pitching velocity is enough. And then also there's just an element of randomness that, we've been fortunate, but I do think the people in the room and the players themselves, I don't think we're guessing as much as we once did or once had to. We have some cool things that we can track and, it's worked so far.
There's a lot of black box stuff here that you I've asked you over the years to tell me about. You won't tell me, and I know you won't now, but I mean, you guys, I mean, like the starters that you've now targeted and the sort of repertoire and profile that they have, do you think there's something to, prioritizing some of the stuff you guys have with those guys on the mound that also keeps them not only effective, but available?
Yeah, I think, pitching at its core is about not walking guys, striking enough guys out, not giving up damage. So the combination of, leveraging pitches that get early contact and get weak contact and knowing when and why and where we want to hunt with for a strikeout and understanding which one of those is needed at each time, I do think it's nudged us towards a way of thinking that's more efficient based, because there's also a way to be really efficient if you strike guys out, but you can't strike a guy out until you're two strikes. So that's where stuff comes in. So I think a combination of stuff and kind of our decision making. So it's JT, what pitches he calls, the pitcher, and how we kind of nudge certain things inside the count, I think does help. It's not a one-to-one with health, but not laboring is a good thing, and not having really tough innings is a good thing, which helps you pitch longer. But also, you got to have good stuff to be efficient. You got to have good stuff to not have the stressful innings. So, stuff is very important to us, but also understanding what stuff is, because stuff isn't just velocity. Stuff's right. Movement, stuff is unique. You can look at different slots, different presentations. Like if you're different than most of the league, your stuff is good and you could throw 90 and be good. But
now you're on a point now that I want to get to, because The thing that sticks out, Caleb, early on is that you guys are very different in one way. Well, multiple ways, but this is the way that stuck out to me, is that you guys are making sinkers cool again. Like now you are among your starting staff, you've thrown the highest percentage of sinkers of any starting staff in baseball. It's more than double the league average. What's going on here?
Well, in some ways it's like you're scheming up an NFL offense. Like we have good sinkers. So, you rewind 4, 5, 6 years ago, there might be something saying like, well, this is a bad pitch. We shouldn't throw it. Sinkers get crushed. And that's still kind of true if you don't have the platoon advantage, but same sided sinkers are maybe one of the better pitches in baseball. Like that, it's not going to produce the most whiff, but it is it's a really nice piece that you need to probably do. You can pose different problems. So you look at Zach Wheeler. He's the best example. Before the sweeper, he was dominant in the major leagues by basically posing a problem to right-hand hitters, which is sinker in or four seam away. And I will go up and I'll mix, you know, off speed every now and then. Yeah. So it's first rules. It's got to work. We have good sinkers, and doesn't make sense to me that it's like, oh, we should chase this and change someone. So kind of leveraged. And if it works, we do it a little more. If it keeps working, we try to find a sweet spot, but I know we're number one in that. We throw sinkers, but we do talk about, like, you know, it's a little more, if you have the platoon, like, that's a really good option. The plate actually, it functionally is a little bit bigger and off same sided because the ball's going ball to strike the ball, especially depending on where you're on the rubber. So there's a lot of benefits, but yeah, I mean, it's worked and we have good ones. If we didn't have good ones, we probably don't throw as many sinkers, but I feel like we have a lot of good sinkers, and planning that pitch is important, especially right on left, left on right, but it doesn't come before throwing strikes, and a sinker is a pretty good strike pitch.
Right, to that point, I mean, I think the slugging percentage I'm looking at right now, it's like sixth best slugging percentage on those sinkers by starting pitchers, so it's working.
Yeah, and it's not, you're probably not looking at sinkers like you can a four seam where you can get into this outlier territory where you can just roll them in there. And there's a lot of whiff to it. There's not a lot of whiff, but, you know, getting the ball on the ground. It's one of the stats, you know, I really like the combination of strikeout rate, ground ball rate, which we're doing pretty good in. And if you keep the ball on the ground, you strike guys out, it's a pretty good recipe for success. So, and then we probably as an industry and baseball, like, demonize that pitch way too much. And I think it's cool to see it come back a little bit.
You know, I think Zach Wheeler was an interesting point there just a second ago, because you're right. He was dominant, a Cy Young Award finalist, you know, before adding in a couple of new pitches right over the last couple of years. And I'm curious about what that looks like, right? I mean, Zach is a little bit of a freak. He can just kind of come in and throw a 70 grade splitter, I guess, when he feels like it. But what is it like when a guy comes to you and is like, hey, I want to try this? Or he works with you and the rest of the staff is like, what can we do? Can I add a weapon that gets me, you know, in on a lefty's hands? Is a cutter going to work for me? Yeah. How does it work with these guys when they come in and they want to add something or tweak something? Is that just an off-season thing and then you work on it in spring and see what happens? What does that look like?
I have a strong preference for off-season, especially on a pitch creation. If we're creating a pitch and adding a pitch, I do think it can be done in season. It just has to be handled with a lot more care, and probably – You definitely need to go slower in season. I think Zach's a pretty cool example. Like, it's kind of, if you're going to add a pitch, it's one, you got to have a talented guy that has, call it hand talent, which Zach does. He can, he understands now, like, kind of what makes balls move in different directions. So he can kind of reconcile that with his delivery, his hands. So he understands that. And then you start from that point, and Zach specifically, his harder slider that's more gyro in nature that he would throw lefties and righties, he still throws it to lefties. It just didn't perform well, so he wasn't happy with that. And there were good pitches that weren't swung at, and then there's good pitches that were damaged and just didn't perform how we thought it should too, and how he thought it should. So we wanted to develop a pitch, and it was kind of my white whale for a little bit, because Zach's kind of the blueprint for a guy that you might throw a sweeper. He's a little more around the ball. You know, the sinker is, he cuts the sinker a little bit. He throws a cutter, and his four seam's not super spin efficient. So, you know, he's kind of the guy on paper that you would do it. But, you know, with there's a huge amount of respect and waiting until you need to do it versus, like, preemptive strike, hey, we should throw this pitch because it's cool. Zach wanted to do it. So we tried a bunch of grips in the off season, and he landed on one. He got a ton of reps that maybe weren't even good reps in the off season. So got to spring training, and we honed it in and honed it in and honed it in. And it was okay to start the year, but he kept throwing it. We kept working on it. And by the end of the year, I mean, it was a pretty special pitch, and it performed significantly better than his hard slider. He traded off some ground ball for pop out. And he showed the ability towards the second half to really command the strike zone a little bit with it too, which is tough with that pitch. But that's a good example. Off season, you know, in season, I like to tell guys, if we want to explore and exploit, so the explore, but we don't want to lose sight of how we're going to win tonight. So it's a little bit of double vision. And how would I do this if I wanted to look up in a month or two and I had that pitch and I could put it in my arsenal? So that's, you know, that's some guys with maybe a cutter, that's maybe a Kirkering working on a two seam throughout end of last year. But those are small adjustments, like nudging things to different shapes. But pitch creation, it's a little tougher. You got to be pretty dialed in across departments too.
I mean, that said, like, how impressed are you by the Wheeler splitter? I mean, I'm looking at the, I mean, I haven't looked at the numbers in a while now, but I mean, he's, you know, hitters are 2 for 21 now against it. There's been one extra base hit. Nine of his strikeouts have come on the splitter. I mean, that's a, I think the first time he threw it, I had a scout buddy in the stands and he texted me. He's like, this, I'm crazy, but I think I'm going to put a 70 or 80 on this already.
Yeah. I think one of the first ones he threw too, he struck out Acuna with it.
Yes.
Yeah, he had thrown versions of that in the past, and you know, there's one school of thoughts like, well, just split your fingers and throw it. But then now we can, you know, we can see how the ball's coming off at 10,000 frames. We can see how your delivery's moving on your best, you know, splits with some of the stuff. And for him, it was kind of the same process, but you know, there's a family of splitter grips. And he tried, same thing, he kind of tried, but it's been really impressive. It's another pitch that kind of suits his hand, because most splits are thrown with a little bit of cut to it. Yeah, I mean, it kind of worked right away. It's more, I think, when you watch a left-handed hitter and how they kind of plan for Zach, it's not something they can really plan for, because if they sell out for that, they're gonna be exposed with a lot of stuff up and in.
And so like, and this is like something you said something earlier, and it's crazy to me. And this is your fourth year now, right?
Yeah, it is. That's crazy.
Which is, that makes you the longest tenured Phillies pitching coach in a while. I mean, Rich Doobie did it for a while, but then they went through five different guys over 5 years. And like, you're talking about next level sort of adjustments you guys have been making with pitchers, and you know, that there is a trust factor to that, obviously. So Caleb, I mean, like, what is the difference, you know, 4 years in as opposed to the third year, the second year, the first year? I mean, do you think you're able to do different things, or maybe reach this sort of like almost like a master class with some of these guys, because there is that trust?
Yeah, I mean, it is. There's more familiarity for sure. There's not that first day of school where you got to kind of wait, get to know a guy. Like the guys that come in, that's definitely a piece. But the Zach Wheelers, the Rangers, the Nolas, like there's a lot of history now. There's a lot of notes that, you know, you're kind of looking through middle of 2021 notes on something Nola said, and you like, hey, remember when this was the feel you were on, and it unlocked something 3 years down the road. So that, you know, that's the benefit of A, good pitchers, and B, you know, familiarity and having some history that you can kind of look back and remember things and help them remember things. So trying to, on our end, keep good notes so that we have those things in times of need. But it's easy to forget a lot of stuff, and it's way tougher to move fast when you're in that get to know period. But now with Knowles, it's kind of, you know, it's you're just layering things on top of stuff you've already kind of solidified, and in a lot of ways revisiting and always coming back and realigning to the basics and stuff that we maybe started with. But there's trust, there's two way, there's honesty. I think that's a big thing. It's, hey, does that feel good? No. Do you want to try that? Yes. So we don't have to play this game. It's clear. We just get to work.
You know, Nola is one of those guys who has this reputation as a workhorse in a league that has seen a dwindling population of workhorses, right? It's been almost anathema the last couple of years for a starting pitcher to go a third time through the order, even into the regular season, much less the playoffs, as a strategic thing, whatever. But this year, your guys in the rotation have faced the most batters in the majors the third time through the order or beyond. Now, that's got to be a point of pride, I would think, because much like you were talking about, it's sort of like getting into that frontier, getting ahead of things, being one of the organizations, teams on the cutting edge of of the league. What kind of planning goes into getting these guys ready and equipped to get that third time or that fourth time even through the order? Because there is so much change involved in either the usage or spotting, because as the batters get more looks, you feel like they're more equipped within a game. What does that look like? And how have you been able to get this rotation to stay so effective deep into games so far this year?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, third time through is real. It's been real forever. But kind of the foundational things that we think, something we say is first time through, make them deal with you and establish your strengths. Second time through, do we need to pivot? And has the hitter deserved something that we need to change course on? And third time, there's a little bit of just being a magician. That's a lot with JT. So there's like, if you just go straight, spam the best rec, the best card, and Nola just throws 50-60% curveball, it's less likely that he can confuse the hitter third time through. They've seen these things. So like at its core, you need options. You need multiple offerings. You potentially, as a starter, I do think for the most part, you need two fastballs. You need a good off-speed pitch. You need to be able to create randomness in the strike zone. So there's one way to pitch where it's like, you know, Greg Maddux hit down and away 7 out of 10 times. Or if you throw strikes with all your pitches and you're random with your mix, a lot of times most people would leave that game being like, wow, that was great command. So keeping the plan relatively simple and not really addressing the hitter. We know the hitter, but we're not going to like, we're going to respect the hitter by giving him everything we got, and let's see how that goes. So the options, but also the end game, that's where JT is such a weapon. JT's recall is fantastic. And, you know, we keep notes in the dugout so that we know, you know, how we led guys, what's this swing and miss probably telling us. And then there's just the whole layer of art of pitching where, you know, golly, Ranger Suarez, if he throws a four seam in and he gets a certain type of take, what does that tell him? Versus a sinker away and there's a swing, what does that tell him? So there's, you know, the cliche is you got to know how to read hitters, but actually peeling that apart and like, what are the couple things that you need to notice? And if the plan's simple and I'm thinking clear and I'm not thinking about all these fancy things, now I have an opportunity to notice things about the hitter, and all that equals is playing the game. You're actually inside the game, playing the game against the hitter. You're not, well, I need to get to 30% changeup usage. I need to get my front side to this spot. You're wrapped up in the game, and that at its core, that is what this thing's all about. So, you know, kind of ranty on a philosophical stance, but third time through, you need planning. You need good pitches. You need to be paying attention. You need to remember. We need to have conversations. But yeah, it's definitely a thing of pride, because it is very tough to do that in the big leagues. And I don't care who you're facing, and it's real for a reason. Like guys see you, they come up with a better plan the second time, and you would think they'd come up with even a better plan the third time. But you know, our pitchers are pretty good, and they can pose a bunch of different problems to hitters. You know, whether it's Knowles, Wheels, Ty, Sanchi, Ranger, for sure, once he added the cutter and curveball, like he can kind of attack you like 4 or 5 different ways. And once you decide to sell out on something to go get it, you better get it that time, because that's the last time you're probably going to see it from Ranger.
So, Kale, I mean, I've seen you know, behind the scenes now for the last 3-4 years now, like how you've developed relationships. And you know, you obviously come from a unique perspective in that you did play in the major leagues. You were an early adopter at Driveline. Like the way you talk, obviously, like you have an advanced, you know, knowledge and or you dig very deep into the different metrics of pitching. I mean, I'm surprised. I can't believe we haven't seen a t-shirt yet, because Zach in the spring said he's my pitching nerd. I you know, where's that t-shirt? How come we haven't seen that yet? But like, what?
That'd be a good t-shirt.
I can't believe nobody's done that. So what, how do you, but you're not just a nerd. I mean, I think that's been pretty clear, because you have gained the trust of some guys who aren't necessarily that into analytics, or, you know, what we call analytics. What has that challenge been like for you, and why do you think you've been successful in gaining that trust with guys? Because the way you're talking to us, you're not necessarily talking to pitchers, some of the pitchers that way, but you're using those principles.
Yeah, and I think it is a very hot topic, but I think at its core, one of my core whys, and it's something I felt as a player, I would die on the hill that players want to be better. Pitchers want to be better. Mm. Like, they want to be good at this game. They want to do it for different reasons. You know, it could be to take care of their family. It could be for success. It could be to win a championship, win a Cy Young, whatever that is. They want to be better. They don't want to go out there and be worse or be bad. So all this, all the things, it's just information. So analytics, it's a buzzword, but it's really, we're all doing an analysis. You're just picking, you're kind of creating your own analytics no matter what we're talking about. So when things are confusing, that's what I'm not okay with confusion, but I also think these guys can handle more than we give them credit for a lot of times, because if we don't understand it in such a, in a way that we can explain it, you know, parroting, I think it was Richard Feynman, scientist. Now I sound like a nerd.
There we go.
But if you can't explain it to a 5-year-old, you don't understand it enough. So like, we could talk about seam shifted wake, seam effects, all this stuff, but it's, if you can boil that down to, I want you to hook your finger and throw a fastball and then the pitch is better and they feel that. Now you get this light bulb kick of the discovery where, you know, they know that was better, that felt better, and that's better. You don't have to, you don't have to explain all these things. Now there's a big piece of kind of proving your work and showing your work, and like, hey, there's a lot of times we do sit down, it's like, hey, I just want to show you how we got to this. I don't need you to understand this, but I want to show you and walk you through like the line of thinking and tell me where we're off. Like, because the biggest thing in all this is you layer information analytics on top of a player that doesn't understand and it's not part of their solution and their why, it doesn't work. So it needs to be something that aligns with their values and why they're doing what they're doing and what they want. Because at its core, I'm trying to take guys to where they want to go. And balancing that with, you know, winning games and putting them in the best spots to have the most success. Because to win a championship, you got to win a bunch of games. You need to win today, but also there's a little bit of double visions. It's maybe sacrificing a little bit here and there for the bigger picture, whether it's back to what we started with health. But, you know, I want complex things to feel simple, and I want there to be clarity first and foremost with anything we do. So we work real hard to get things like looking cool for players when it gets in front of them, looking very simple, but also having the ability to show our work, because guessing doesn't work either. And, you know, demanding things and generaling, hey, you need to throw a sweeper because it's a higher stuff grade. But if that doesn't align with someone's vision for success, it's just going to break down.
That is, and I love a good segue. That is a wonderful segue to one last question before we let you go, as the team gets ready to finish up a strange little wraparound series with the Giants here on Monday. And that is thinking ahead, thinking forward, looking toward the future a little bit. Now, obviously, you're the major league pitching coach right now. You're dealing mostly with the guys who are on the major league staff. But how much of your job involves working with, you know, Preston Mattingly and the development side to try and prep some of these minor leaguers for potential debuts, or the guys who have been brought in to pitch for Lehigh and maybe be, you know, the Jose Ruizes, the Luis Ortizes, who are going to be called upon, you know, for some of this up and down work as they try and get back to the major leagues? How much do you have to balance what you do with the current major league staff with the potential tomorrow major league staff members?
I balance it with some help. Brian Kaplan, Cesar Ramos, who was in AAA last year. They, you know, Cap's role is, he is kind of the expert in the room, and he's on top of it. He's watching the games while we're playing. He's sometimes in the clubhouse. We have all the games on, so we're plugged in. We have a bunch of reports. We have a bunch of ways to communicate, take notes, share notes. It's just, to me, it's effort. But I would say there's a lot of that going on. Like, very plugged in with AAA, And then as the guys, as we go down levels, it's a little more like higher level, but I'd say we want to be really dialed in that AAA, their process with book down there, that as much as we possibly can have it a clone of how we're doing it here. And then you're kind of like regressing, whether it's our game planning process or, you know, how we talk or how we work, you're kind of regressing it back as we go down in levels. But AAA, we want guys to be able to come up and go down and have it be the exact same. So it's a daily thing. There's daily conversations about whether it's Mick or Mercado or Ruiz, and hey, this is working. Hey, this is what we're working on. You know, we send information back and forth with players that are called up or sent down. So it's a really important piece, because you don't want like a Ruiz to get called up and now all of a sudden it's different. Now all of a sudden we're talking different. The game is different. The documents are different. The practice feels different. You know, we want it to feel very familiar, but on a really broad scale, we want everything we do with every pitcher to be rooted in who we are and what we do. So it's coaches coaching inside of who we are. So it's good. And Cap, he definitely helps a lot, because it is tough to, you know, you can only watch so much video. So having him, it's a weapon. And, you know, the people, Caesar and Book, and their level of communication, it's been really good this year. And I think we've gotten better over the years there for sure.
All right. Wonderful stuff. All right. You got a game to prep for tonight, so we'll let you go. Phillies pitching coach, Caleb Cotham. Caleb, thank you so much for joining us today. This has been fantastic.
Appreciate it, Paul. Thanks, Matt. Appreciate you guys having me on.
See ya.
Our thanks once again to Phillies pitching coach Caleb Cotham for joining us, for being our first double interview. It's really interesting to conduct something like this completely remotely in three different locations. It's the wonder of the future that we were.
It was really cool though. I think, you know, I've had a lot of conversations with Caleb over the last few years, and some of them for interviews and some of them where I'm, you know, it's my job, you know, to try to have as good of a feeling as I can about, you know, understanding things. And I there's a lot of stuff about pitching that I do not understand and I will never understand. And you know, he's gracious enough to kind of, if I have a question that may not be for a story, that may be just more like I'm trying to understand why this guy did that or why you guys are doing this. He takes some time to explain it. And I do appreciate that. And the first pitching coach I covered, the Phillies, Rich Doobie, was great at that. And like, I was a young reporter and I was, you know, an asshole generally. And he was also a masshole, in his words. And so, you know, we would butt heads, but he helped me understand pitching so much. And I really appreciated that. And I think that, you know, continuity is a huge thing. We mentioned it in the interview. I mean, 4 years now. I mean, think about Paul. I mean, those years where they're just a pitching coach is coming in and out every year. Mm. And continuity, man, is just huge. And Caleb Cotham's trust level inside that clubhouse with that pitching staff is enormous. And I think we're seeing it in the results.
So looking ahead, after the Phillies wrap up this wraparound series with the Giants here on Monday, they have a quick little two-gamer with the underperforming but still not to be underestimated Toronto Blue Jays before hitting the road for their first series against division rivals, the absolutely woeful Miami Marlins, who have already begun their sale.
I don't think they're going to see six, though.
Oh, man. And then two on a home and home with the Mets. Again, structure is a little weird here because of that London series coming up. Matt, the Marlins are just,
it's bad.
They are so bad that I know we already had a brush with greatness in the bad department with the White Sox series a couple of
weeks
ago.
And the Rockies.
The Rockies,
I mean, it's a great competition for who is the worst. The Marlins, I think, are the worst team. I think they are the worst team.
Yeah.
And they're only going to get worse because they're clearly going to trade whoever they have, right?
Everything that's not bolted down is going to go. Luis Arraez is already in San Diego. The Marlins, by way of playing two more games, have two more wins than both the White Sox and Rockies. But yeah, that's going to be that's going to be an interesting race to the bottom. But it just looks like more of a chance for, you know, again, not to overlook Toronto and the Mets, especially because those are better teams. But in the near future, the immediate future, it looks like a chance for this team to bank more games and, you know, keep adding to that already somewhat gaudy win total to try
just
and
keep
pad.
Winning series. I mean, they haven't lost a series since the second series of the year. Yep. They haven't won every single one since. They've split 2-4 gamers in there, but they haven't lost a series since the second series of the season.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So things are going well right now. You just hope the health of everybody else keeps up for as long as it can. Hopefully Trey's recovery goes speedily and we see him back on the field before too long. Matt, before we say goodbye for this week, anything else you're looking forward to over this upcoming week?
Better weather.
That'd be nice.
Yeah, that'd be great.
That's it. I mean, yeah, there's not really a whole lot of room at the top end, is there? Things are going pretty well. This is unusual for the show to be like this. I'm not complaining. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a lot of different storylines to pursue here. I mean, I do think what they do at the middle is going to be interesting. I do. I think that Stott at short and Whit Merrifield at second makes a lot of sense. And I think there's a good chance that we'll see that more often. But it's going to be about some of these other guys. I think, picking up the slack.
All right. Keep an eye on that over the coming week. All right. Thanks again, Matt, for you, of course, for always being on here with me. And we can't say enough thanks to Caleb Cotham, Phillies pitching coach, for joining us and also tolerating us. That'll do it for this week. We will catch you next week with another brand spanking new episode after hopefully the Phillies dispatch with the Marlins. For Matt, I am Paul. We'll see you then.